Well, welcome, everybody. That you choose a session on the denial of a diminished planet over a session on the pilgrimage of poets causes me to doubt your judgment. This may be a gathering of sadomasochists, I'm not sure. This I'm not promising any fun. I hope we have some. But the topic will not bring you fun, per se. We might have some fun doing this, and I hope there is some levity. This is a third session that circles around what I'm trying to propose as a shift in our moral universe, in the way in which we see the world and think about it, and the consequent sense of responsibility that we feel and have for it. I'm trying to, for Christian ethics, put earth, air, fire, and water at the center of our sense of responsibility. And to relocate the life of faith and morality in keeping with the basic tenet of Thomas Berry, in this case, planetary health is primary, human well-being is derivative. Because the whole modern era since the rise of the Industrial Revolution has operated on the assumption that human well-being is primary and the planet will have to learn to live within our means. Marilyn Robinson, whom you may know from Gilead or some of her other writings, says, I think we all know now that the Earth might be reaching the end of its tolerance of our presumptions. Well, the end, the presumption that human well-being is primary is one that belongs to those assumptions. The handwriting is on the wall. Now, the wall itself is the north wall of the farmer's market in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And the handwriting is a line from Wendell Berry in this case. To cherish the remains of the earth and to foster its renewal is our only legitimate hope of survival. So what I'm trying to do in this shift in Christian ethics is to shift our focus to the remains of the earth in order to cherish them as a strategy and necessity of survival. Now, the last epigraph is from Charles Darwin. It is not the strongest of species that survives, nor is it the most intelligent of species that survives, but the one that is most adaptable to change. I think we think of ourselves as the strongest species, certainly the most intelligent. The question is, are we the one most adaptable to change? But a lot of the changes now that we must adapt to, come on in. There's some chairs here. There's a sheet to grab back there. The changes that we need to adapt to now are changes that are in part humanly caused. As we'll get into in just a few minutes, a number of scientists say that it is not only political, economic, cultural, religious change that is happening now, it's geophysical change. It's changes to the core surface planetary processes that is happening. And to such an extent that we're moving from That age which has hosted all human civilizations to date, namely the Holocene, we're in the late Holocene, and we're moving into what some scientists are calling the Anthropocene. It's a new geological age. We've not been around for a change of geological ages as a species. And this one that we're moving into is in part the result of human-induced geophysical changes. So that's why I will argue later in the week about a partnership of science and religion, coming to terms with that. Yeah, a couple more chairs up front here. In fact, good ones, padded ones. I've talked about water in one session, about soil in another session, and logically I should move on to fire and air. But today we're going to talk about the denial of a diminished planet. This truth of Barry's, planetary health is primary, human well-being is derivative, is probably something that has been true always. We've depended upon the goods of the commons, earth, air, fire, and water, for any common good that could come for human beings. But what precipitates the necessity of talking about human responsibility in a new way now is that we're the causes of a diminishing of the planet, and we're largely in denial about it. And so I want us to, in this session, kind of confront that denial, because we're not likely to make the changes we need to make as an adaptable species until we do confront that denial. yesterday in the Cain story about Cain's alienation from the soil, which is the alienation from his own identity, because all things are created from Adama, including the cultivator, the conclusion was that fratricide is ecocide. Human injustice done to one another has consequences, and now there are more and more consequences for the planet. But what precipitates today's session is the reverse. Ecocide is fratricide. If we don't make planetary health our primary, it's sure than death and taxes that we will suffer as a consequence. So let's confront this. Now, there's a lot of attention these days given to climate change denial, and we can talk about that. The American Psychological Association's list of obstacles to accepting climate change reads like a catalog of biblical afflictions. You think you're with John Bunyan here. Ignorance, mistrust, mulishness, denial, habit, impotence, what can I do? Tokenism, conflicting goals, belief in divine intervention, all of those things play into climate change denial, according to the American Psychological Association. And this list doesn't include people's habitual dislike for delayed benefits. Or the reality that most of us, you know, kind of operate with a finite pool of worry, and we can just fret about so much at any one time. So John Kenneth Galbraith is right. Faced with the choice between changing one's mind and proving there is no need to do so, almost everybody gets busy with the proof. And that despite the fact that we, I think, all know that the Earth is growing less and less tolerant of our presumptions. But I think to focus on climate change denial is to badly misplace the debate. Climate change is symptom more than cause. Now, it's also a cause of a lot of things, too. But in this particular case, the underlying cause for the diminished planet is the kind of economy that we have and the way of life that we live. Yes, these are generating the climate change, but we could readily admit to climate change as real and simultaneously work furiously to get the economy back on track. We might concur with climatologists while denying that our way of life must fundamentally be changed, the one that's bringing the climate change. So that's why I think it may be a misplaced debate to focus on climate change, although I do that often, because then you do get at. If you probe that, you find out that climate change is kind of a chapter in the history of Revelation, and it's revealing something about us and our world that we need to pay attention to. So I'm not playing it down. I'm saying that unless you get to the economy, denial about our economy, you haven't gotten to the right place. The diminished planet is a consequence of unprecedented human population matched to unprecedented global economic activity of a certain kind, a kind fueled by fossil fuels. And if you would take a look at the sheet, has everybody got one? They're back, there's some back there. There's some, you want to pull any chairs in? Yeah, I'm sure you could just, or pull the chairs. You can. There's one here, two here. Oh, yeah. Lots of room.
Three.
Okay. Yep. No, I'll try not to spit. Oh, yeah, well, it took me a long time to identify myself as an ethicist without spitting on somebody. If you take a look at page 56 of this front and back sheet, you will see the drivers of all of these hockey stick graphs. In the top line, the first two reading from left to right, population and total real gross domestic product. So it's the combination of unprecedented human population match to unprecedented economic activity that's going to drive everything on the rest of these graphs, both front page and back. We've gotten away from talking about population issues ever since 1992, UN conference in Cairo, Egypt on sustainability and population, and the world just couldn't find a way to talk about population issues, and that has faded from the scene. We're going to have to bring it back. We don't have to do it in the way that the magazine The Onion does. The Onion had an article that says, it's clear now from science that the planet can sustain a human population of 3 billion. We've just turned 7 billion. We're going to have to reduce the population by 4 billion. Now, how do you want to go about doing that? So, so we've gotten away from being able to talk about this, but we're going to have to talk about this. There is no path to sustainability for us and much of the community of life. Earth will go on. That's not the issue. Earth will endure. But there, for us and a whole lot of the rest of the community of life, there is no way of getting to sustainability without probably at least leveling off, which is likely to do by the middle of this century, but at somewhere near 9 to 10 billion. Just take a look at that graph. There is no fine print to read, but if you could read the fine print, you would see that at the beginning of the last century, 1900, the population on the planet was 1.6 billion. Now, it took all of human history to get to 1.6 billion. By the end of that one century, the beginning of this century, the number had flipped. 6.1 billion went from 1.6 to 6.1 in 100 years. And then in 2010, we passed 7 billion. So it's unprecedented human growth. But that wouldn't of itself, be the problem. I mean, if you put us all in cold storage, you wouldn't have a sustainability problem. It's matching that population, what the human population needs, to the kind of economic activity that we have that creates the problem. And that's why that second graph, which is another hockey stick here, and you might note here, as I mentioned at the top of the page, that the 1750 is the conventional date for the onset of the Industrial Revolution. This unprecedented economic activity has only been made possible by virtue of stored energy in the form of fossil fuels. Otherwise, you can't do it. But that has made this possible. And so you have, things are gradual for quite a while, and then 1950 is the date on all of these graphs where you have a screeching acceleration. And human society actually leaves the constraints of the past. Now, what happened about that time? Why 1950? Why is it kind of gradual until 1950 and then like that?
Post-World War II.
Yeah.
The baby boom.
Baby boom, post-World War II. Yeah. Yeah.
Oil.
What? Oil. Oil. Lots of oil. Yeah, the fossil fuels available. I'll get into, well, maybe you know this too, Brian. If you're as old as, if you were about 6 years older than I am, you would have lived through the period when 97% of all of the oil that has been burned has been burned. And if you're 25 years old, I think about a quarter of it. I mean, it is. It is that consumption of fossil fuels giving us unprecedented energy that has made this possible. And it is the baby boom, and it is post-World War II. What happened was you shifted from a war-based economy to an economy that was deliberately formulated as an economy of consumerism. And it was an explicit policy. I can go through the details on that, that happened in the Roosevelt administration and then legislation in the Truman administration. And the mature economy, W.W. Rostow, the stages of economic growth, is the mature economy is the economy of mass consumption. And things were put in place to generate that kind of economy. So that's why 1950 is the date here where you see this screeching acceleration. Okay, then you might just want to look at the other items on the graph. But what I want to underscore as so striking is that these look like items that don't have a lot of connection, relationship to one another. I mean, what does the number of McDonald's restaurants have to do with fertilizer consumption? Well, something. Yeah. Or international tourism to do with urban population and the damming of rivers and direct foreign investment. Or, well, the backside is what's happening to the planet. It's on page 57. CO2 concentration, nitrous oxide, that's another greenhouse gas concentration. Changes in the atmosphere, ozone depletion, changes in surface temperature, floods. I don't think we have drought on here, but we got floods. Changes in ocean ecosystems in the coastal zone, changes in the biogeochemistry of coastal zones. The oceans are changing more now, acidifying faster than they have for millions of years, actually. They're different oceans. They're not the oceans that your grandparents sailed on or went swimming in. Changes in terrestrial ecosystems. Actually, the oceans are losing ecosystems faster than the rainforests. No. The changes in global biodiversity, which means less diversity, which incidentally is critical to adaptability or lack thereof. So you've got this screeching acceleration where we've left the regimes, the energy regimes, the food regimes of the past, and you have those lines being extended. Now this goes to 2000. If you want, we can talk about what's happened in the decade since. The short answer to that is that despite the recession, all of those lines continue upward. They're not falling off. The diminished planet is a consequence of all of this, and climate change is one of the results. A planet of melting permafrost, polar caps, and glacial fields, including the ones around Holden Village. At some point, the village is going to have to figure out how to get its electricity, probably from Railroad Creek, if the snowpack isn't sufficient, because we've been depending in part upon glacial melt as well as snowpack. We'll get more of it, but the glaciers up there in Copper Basin, there are glaciers up there, are melting. Now, this last year, we had lots and lots of snow, so it's not an immediate worry. But in the great rivers of Asia, upon which the great civilizations of Asia depend, are rivers that depend upon the Himalayan snowpack for them. So it's a big issue there. We've had a continuing increase despite the recession in carbon, nitrous oxide, and methane emissions, the greenhouse gases. We've got record drought and record deluge and the heaviest ocean acidification in hundreds of thousands of years. The chemistry of that other great commons, the atmosphere, is likewise altering rapidly at levels not seen in millions of years. That's why the scientists are saying this is a new geological age. And for us, it's a diminished planet, and for much of life. it's not all climate change. You've got a degrading of soils that has other causes. Unsustainable levels of freshwater use, not a cause of climate change. Just as you've got a loss of biodiversity with other causes, so severe that adaptability, which is the key to survival and creativity, is increasingly compromised. The planet's biological loss includes the death of birth itself in the form of species extinction. Some people talking about the sixth great wave of species extinction. It's happened before, and just never in the lifetime of Homo sapiens as a species, and never has its part of its cause been a human cause. So the death of birth itself, the loss of rainforests and woodlands, the widespread disruption of ecosystems, dead zones off many river deltas, and this precipitous fall off in biodiversity. So the planet's community of life is already markedly diminished, and the trend lines are moving in the wrong direction. These graphs, just to tell you where they come from, are a project of the International Geosphere Biosphere Program. It's a group of scientists from around the world that assembled these over a period of years, put them in a big, thick volume, and put these two figures, these two pages of graphs, as a kind of summary of watching global trends in a whole lot of different areas. If you want more, I forgot to bring that sighting, but I'll get it. They go on, the scientists in this book go on to compare these timelines, 1750 to the present, or not the present, 2000, with even longer ones. And they say, and I'm quoting them now, evidence from several millennia shows that the magnitude and rates of human driving changes to the global environment are in many cases unprecedented. There is no previous analog for the current operation of the Earth system. There is no previous analog for the current operation of the Earth system. So we don't really know what we're doing. At least we don't have an analogy here within human time. And they're the ones that go on to announce a new geological age, the Anthropocene, whose distinguishing mark is that the planet's core surface processes are now dominated by human activities in ways that result in this geophysical change. Okay, that's what I wanted to say about the the diminished planet. These graphs also, so let's turn to denial issues, but these graphs are taken up by James Gustav Speth in a book, The Bridge to the Edge of the World. He uses them there, and he calls these graphs the Great Collision. The collision is the collision of the global human economy with the economy upon which it's dependent and of which it is a part, namely the economy of nature. That's what makes for unsustainability, is the collision of the global human economy with the economy of nature, because we're a part of the economy of nature. We not only draw upon it, we impact it. That's the Anthropocene. Wendell Berry calls this the collision of the big economy, by which he means the human economy, with the great economy, which is the economy of nature, in which the big economy sits. what's your reaction to all this? My reaction to all of this is, I want to ecologize capitalism.
That's all.
That's all, yeah. This is what we've got to do. If we want to make this economy congruent with the economy of nature, then we've got to figure out a way to make capitalism observe what nature requires for its own renewal and its own regeneration on its own slow, complex terms. So if you want to stay with this economy of capitalism, you're going to have to ecologize it. You're going to have to make it work with the economy of nature. It's easier to convince U.S. Americans of the end of the world than it is to convince them of the end of capitalism.
There's a difference.
There is. And I think we're into a whole lot of economic denial. If you want to listen to Jesus talk about this, read Luke 5:36-39 about new wineskins. Jesus says, we've got new wine. It's the Anthropocene. That's our new wine. A diminished planet. That's our new wine. You can't put new wine into old wineskins or sew new cloth onto old cloth. For the old wineskins will burst and all will be lost. And then Jesus says at the end of that parable, but people will say the old is good. And their very first response will be to put new wine into old wineskins. That's exactly what we're trying to do when we're trying to get this economy of those pages back on track. We're trying to green consumption so as to make our way of high consumption, the mature economy, continue to work. The question is, can we? Maybe we can, and maybe we can create, there are lots of people working on new wineskins, and it's fun to talk about them, and it's very important. But I think that in this case, it's correct to say that mostly what we're trying to do is put new wine into old wineskins. We're trying to continue the industrial technological paradigm, and we're trying to, through the environmental movement, to green it. Green that one, rather than work at an alternative one. Because that is the economy, 1750 to the present, that has resulted in enormous human benefits. That's why you and I are living longer. They're just enormous human benefits that have resulted. So you can see why would like to deny anything that threatens the continuation of that. All right. What manner of denial is the denial of a diminished planet? While the drama itself is new for Homo sapiens, geophysical state change, the arrival of the Anthropocene, the planet in jeopardy at human hands, the dramatics, I think, are quite familiar. This is tragedy arising from an essential blindness, the inability of the tragic figure to see the flaw in himself or herself. Hamlet could have pulled his life together, says Bill DeBuys. Lear might have appraised the motives of his daughter and himself more shrewdly. Macbeth might have ignored his wife, and Othello trusted his. But they didn't. On contemporary blindness, Bill DeBuys, who's written a very good book called About Our Part of the World, A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the Future of the American Southwest. And this is from his book. Our contemporary blindness DeBuise says, may be less a matter of reasoning than of cognition. Meaning that while the human brain and nervous system are well adapted to immediate threats, they don't do well with ones that seem gradual and distant. So we react to even a non-venomous snake or a loud bang as real threats, while we ignore a couple billion pistons firing daily, accomplishing global warming with no feeling of threat at all. It seems that when it comes to the longer-term problems that engage reason alone, we can think about them. We know that that's what's coming. As we work through this, when it comes to longer-range problems that engage reason alone while leaving the emotions and adrenal glands at rest, humans are not much better than the legendary frog in the gradually warming pot. The reason I want to talk about a partnership of science and religion in Saturday's session is because I think it's doubtful that science can meet the challenge of lazy adrenaline and flaccid emotions on its own. Maybe in partnership with religion and other things, it can. And science is utterly indispensable in what we're talking about in the future. But it can't answer this on its own any more than I think technological fixes can. Here's the tough issue, as I mentioned. It's hard to convince us that we need something other than the capitalism we've got. And just as the market has become the model for society itself, not just for, like Adam Smith thought, trucking and bartering and exchange, but the market for society, not just an economy, within society, so too the capitalist economy has become the phantom cosmology of our time. The source of our daily habits, the source of our daily values. So when there's a fundamental conflict between the global economy and nature's economy, getting the human economy back on track wins hands down. And that's even happened in Europe, where they're ahead of us on legislation about climate change. When the crunch comes, there they give in to the demands, how we put it, this is religion, folks, this is the sacrificial demands, the demands of the economy. In mammon we trust. It's our secular religion against which it is not advisable to blaspheme. This is sacrosanct. I'm going to finish now with my part of this in order to get us discussing by drawing on John Bellamy Foster, who outlines three successive stages of economic denial. We don't need to spend any time with the first one. It's the denial that there is any planetary ecological crisis. More and more people have have experienced facts that kick in their own locales. And this denial of a planetary ecological crisis is fading. The second stage is the denial not of the eco-crisis, but of capitalism itself as the underlying cause of the diminished planet. I'm going to take an example from what is conventional environmental wisdom. There is a formula that I've been running around, has for quite a while. Let me get it right. In environmental circles, it's the IPCT formula. And I'll spell it out. the environmental impact, I, is a result of population, P, times consumption, times technology. So population growth consumption habits and environmentally inappropriate technology yield the planetary crisis. That's what that formula will tell you. And it explains a lot. The solution then, of course, is sustainable population, sustainable consumption, sustainable technology. Foster says, yeah, okay, that's a helpful formula to describe what's going on, but it's better at description than explanation. It doesn't lay bare the underlying economic forces. So I suspect that, pick a few, British Petroleum, IBM, Walmart, you and I, will all sign on for sustainable population, sustainable consumption, and sustainable technology, so long as green corporations and green markets don't subvert our economy and its religion. In fact, the advice of stage two denial is to turn capitalism's genius loose in ways that encompass more of the planet's well-being. Cap and trade markets, maybe a carbon tax, LED bulbs, solar panels, everyone like Nyla and I driving our Prius to Home Depot. All of us driving our Priuses to Home Depot is not the answer to a diminished planet. So this describes better than it explains. It doesn't explain the underlying economic dynamics together with population. This takes us to Foster's third stage. And you should be like my former colleague Emily Towns walked into a class at Yale and on justice, and she said, "You're here to talk about justice. I hope everyone's feeling very, very uncomfortable." So, you should start feeling uncomfortable here. This is Foster's third stage. He says it's a last-ditch defense, and he considers it the most dangerous stage of denial. This stage does recognize a fundamental incompatibility of the consumer-driven globalist economy with nature's economy. So we do need a different economy, an entirely new kind of capitalism, variously called sustainable capitalism, green capitalism, natural step capitalism, and now climate capitalism, and is represented by thinkers like Al Gore and Paul Hawkins and Amory Lovins and Thomas Friedman. The argument is that the answer to the accumulating ecological catastrophe is to make capitalism more efficient by internalizing costs to the environment that have previously been externalized. Capitalism has always lived on externalities. By internalizing the costs, exponential growth ad infinitum can be made to coexist with a planet that's not growing. That's the plan. Even the MIT research group that warned in a recent Smithsonian magazine of a global economic collapse and precipitous population decline by 2030 if we continue to consume at the present rate goes on to say, quote, "unlimited economic growth," that's our religion, "is still possible if world governments enact policies and invest in green technologies that limit our ecological footprint." Okay, like denial's second stage, here too, a changed capitalism is the planet's savior rather than its culprit. Foster himself thinks this is delusional because the basic dynamics of competitive capitalism always seeks to externalize costs in the pursuit of growth and profit on other peoples and on the rest of nature and on future generations. That's how it works. To internalize all costs, including those for future generations for Foster, is the end of capitalism rather than a different kind of capitalism. Now, I would put it somewhat differently. The baseline issue is the metabolic rift between the global human economy and the rest of nature's economy. Whether it's capitalism or industrial socialism or whatever, what you've got to pay attention to is the metabolism. Metabolism, whether in the single cell or the global economy, is about the physical and chemical changes necessary for ongoing life. Post-1750 metabolism, and especially post-1950 economic metabolism, is drastically out of phase with the rest of nature's metabolism. That's the problem. All industrialized nature, both capitalism and state-sponsored socialism, opened a wide metabolic rift that has issued in a diminished planet. And they did so for the same reason: the triumph of this industrial technological paradigm. The drivers of both of modern metabolism are short-term and growth-oriented. That was the case for socialism, too. And you can do it because we've got fossil fuels. Nature's metabolism, by contrast, is long-haul. It's often very slow, the work of generations, some things the work of centuries and millennia, with unbounded growth of any one kind, the very kind of condition that defines plagues, a condition that nature then tries to combat and recover from, unprecedented growth, rather than sustain as exponential growth. The human economy's metabolism in the form of capitalism pushes to simplify complex systems. That's what monocropping and agribusiness is about. It's the simplification of complex biological systems. Five major food crops with genes that are not heat resistant. We don't have heat resistant genes. In a time of climate change, does that sound wise to you? The diminishment of biodiversity, but that's how nature's economy works, is on this complex systems rather than simplifying them. Biodiversity in relationships of astounding complexity is, by way of contrast with human simplification, the genius of nature's metabolism and its means of adaptability and survival. But the metabolism of capitalism fights that kind of metabolism. Okay, that's more than enough from my side. How are we going to ecologize capitalism? Or do you want to? Or what are you going to do instead?
Wait, did you just say that that's a delusion?
That's a delusion, but we'll engage in it. Well, I favor all. I live by all kinds of delusion. It's a better part of my day. But
we have lessons from recent history, I think, that are instructive about how difficult, if ever possible. Jimmy Carter was elected on the basis of his environmental emphasis.
Yeah,
it wasn't sexy enough.
No.
And he was defeated by someone who could care less. Yeah. Richard Nixon, a much maligned Republican, one of his, you know, achievements was the EPA.
Oh, many of the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act,
right.
These are all
right.
Republican administration
Absolutely.
Achievements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But not sexy enough. It doesn't touch us personally.
Mm.
That's a tough nut to crack, but I think recent political history tells us that, you know, bright people have tried to push this kind of thing, but I guess in the case of Carter, you know, and Nixon, the economy wasn't connected to their concerns about the environment.
And incidentally, Jimmy Carter never used the word malaise in the speech that was regarded as his malaise speech when he sat in a cardigan sweater and asked us to, to use less energy. But you can continue your point with Al Gore being elected vice president.
Yes.
And in that administration, the shift was to unlimited economic growth as what had to be pushed by the president. And he did.
Yeah. And his re-election depended on that.
Yeah. Bill Clinton. Yeah, and so we got very little out of an administration that had Al Gore as the vice president in the way of movement on this front. Yeah. Yes, you have a delusion to share?
I have a real problem. Because, I mean, here we are sitting in a room full of Christians who believe in transformation and resurrection and new life. And isn't there a way that we should be approaching this from that angle instead putting new wine into old.
Yes, yeah. The great theme of not only Christianity, but religions in general, is death and renewal, birth and rebirth. Most religions started at the edges or bottom of society with a focus on achieving a way of life that was alternative to their dominant culture. Religions have a lot of practice in death and renewal. And we ought to be looking at those own sources as a different place to stand as we confront a time of geophysical change. And I think that that's already showing up. I think there are a lot of religious communities where people are working at new wineskins. And religious environmentalism is alive and well in many sectors. And we could have another whole session about where do we see new wineskins for the new wine, but it's present, and it is in part because those communities have tapped their own resources for that go deeper than 1750 and the modern era. And next week, I think I'm going to do 5 sessions on those resources. It's how asceticism, which is traditions of the simple life that span religious traditions, address consumerism. It's how sacramentalism addresses commodification of all things. It's how prophetic liberative traditions, and especially in the environmental justice movement, address issues of oppression of both people and the land together. It's how wisdom traditions address the folly of making the planet an uncontrolled, unprecedented experiment. And it's how mysticism and its traditions address alienation of ourselves from the soil from which we were created. So I think those deep traditions shared across religions around the dynamic of death and renewal, birth and rebirth, are a different place to stand. And it's happening in a number of religious communities. But I think you're right on. Draw from your own wells here. However, most of us are in the modern world and are so deeply enculturated by modernity as this period where the industrial technological paradigm has yielded such benefits for us, it's very difficult for us to retrieve that which we don't see except through those lenses. So, it's a change of cosmology or worldview and imagination that is in order. And the retrieval of those deep traditions needs to be a retrieval in which they are themselves also converted to the earth at the same time that they're retrieved. Asceticism hasn't always been earth-friendly. It's been anti-women in many of its traditions. But there are traditions of earth honoring asceticism. And any living tradition like Christianity, Islam, Judaism, the indigenous peoples' religions, Hinduism, Shintoism, Jainism, all of these as living traditions are traditions that change, and they're capable of change, and they have the dynamics for change within them. That's why we talk. And the way in which you raise the question assumed that that Christianity is about transformation.
Well, that's theoretically what we're about.
Yeah. Well, it's more than theoretical. That's how it started.
Right.
And that the renewal movements look much the same. They break out from time to time. They have much the same patterns. Yeah.
Humans seem to have a longing for better.
Yeah.
We want better. We want a better relationship with God.
Yeah.
We want better food.
Yeah.
We want better things for our kids.
Yeah.
How we define better, we're really good at moving there.
Uh-huh.
We've been so good at moving to better for us.
Yeah.
That we got what we wanted.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We got what we wanted. Now, what is better 50 years from now or 100 years from now is a really difficult question. But I think if you understand, people thought about what better is 50 years from now or 100 years from now, then they might start thinking about how to get there. Because we're very good at figuring out how to get there.
Yeah,
because once we figure out what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's go backwards 4 years then. 50 years ago, people still thought that better also meant more.
Right.
And that's why we got where we are.
Yeah. But that's your point. It depends on what better,
right.
What better is.
But
no, I mean, we're pretty good at getting there once we decide what better is.
The capitalist ideal that has yoked Christianity to it in many ways.
Yes.
It's you have to escape it somehow.
Hmm. Yeah. No.
Well, back to your fundamental question: can capitalism really provide us in the future? There's a fundamental law of nature that nobody ever discusses, and it's the second law of thermodynamics.
Yes.
Entropy law.
Yeah.
It's never discussed, and you can discuss it here.
That's right. You're right.
It might be possible, or not a mathematician, but it might be possible if you could take that equation.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of I equals P times C times T, it would be I equals P times C times T over E, which is the entropy law.
Mm-hmm.
If you could solve that equation, it might be possible, but I don't think you could solve the equation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that's the right equation, but I think it is.
Uh-huh. What does the entropy law mean for what we're talking about?
The entropy law basically says, let's see if I get this right, energy is not gain or loss, it just changes form from a usable state to an unusable state.
Yeah.
And it's really the underpinnings of sustainability, because you spoke of the planetary metabolism, which you're talking about, is the entropy law.
Yeah.
Most physical scientists would describe entropy as the push toward randomness, the drive to chaos.
Try getting your ice cubes in your bourbon, you know. Once they've melted, you're not getting your ice cubes back.
Yeah.
The best way to understand the entropy law is to think of the concept of recycling.
Uh-huh.
And see if you can close the loop, which is what everybody says to do. You can't.
Yeah. Was it in your session, Brian, or whose session was it? We're talking about. Oh, it was in Jen. Jen's session, where she was talking about recycling. And for most recyclables, it's a downward spiral. You can't. That's downcycling. You don't get back to what you had. It's something less. So you can only recycle paper enough times. You'll get egg cartons out of it, but you won't get the paper back that was recycled, you know, isn't it?
Yeah. So the best you can do is to slow down the process as much as
you
can. Is there any population on Earth that has lost their delusions?
No, but...
maybe so.
But we have had many cultures where the sense of responsibility extended far into the future. That is to say, our present decisions should be decisions such that our kids and grandchildren inherit what we have had. And they've had a time span and a circle of responsibility, an identification with the elements of earth, with soil, with water, with fire, with air. Their own sense of identity of who they were as human beings was intimately and deeply connected with those elements and across time. So you can't say that human beings are incapable of this. You have agriculture in some communities that where people have been growing the same kinds of diverse foods on the same land for hundreds of years, without losing the topsoil, etc. So I don't know if that's without delusion. I will certainly say human beings will always seek to address their own needs. But what kind of anthropocentrism is it? Is it the kind of human centeredness, which is inevitable? Everything has to go through the human mind. Our understanding of nature, everything is from our point of view. Okay, so there's an inevitable anthropocentrism here. But is it the kind of broad anthropocentrism that understands that I'm a creature of soil, I'm a creature of water, I'm a creature of the sun? There have been lots of human beings that have understood themselves in exactly that way. And they have said, we can't leave this place differently. And we found it so that our children don't have what we have in order to meet their needs. I don't know if you call that without delusion, but it's a different way than this short term and kind of shrunken. I think the modern anthropocentrism is a shrunken anthropocentrism. Okay, thanks, folks. As we're calling the bell.